Sure. We were talking about families getting involved in the recovery process.
Yeah.
In the addict's recovery process. And one thing that just comes to mind is a close family friend who has really brought his family down, has been, smoking crack cocaine for years. But in every family gathering, he's there drinking a beer or having a scotch. And then he'll disappear every single week. He disappears, at least once. And I've talked to their family saying, aren't you guys aware that maybe that he should not be drinking? Are you guys aware that we should not be engaging in drinks? Maybe this is why he continues to disappear. This could be a contributing factor in that. And their response is, well, he's never really had a problem with alcohol. It's just, crack, And I'm like, well, they just don't get it.
Yeah,
and I think the more education a family can have as to what really goes on in an addict's mind is can be critical to their success. And I do agree. I think someone said that they know somebody who won't even see an addict unless the family's involved. Yeah. I would be 100% in agreement with that.
Okay. That's good. That is this guy's point. And I don't know how much of he's saying it just for shock value, kind of in the spirit of what Eddie was saying, because it is pretty shocking, the radicality of it. Guy, you've had a lot of experience. I'm just interested in your experience and your own perspective on all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's truth in both sides of the argument, both sides of the continuum. I think for me it would all depend on, if we're looking at it from an integral perspective from the lower left quadrant, I think family takes on a more wider definition in the sense that for me what would be important is the people that are closest to the person in his lives, not so much the family. If the family is his primary sort of social support system or social network, then I would say that it's incredibly important that the family is involved, especially with adolescents or young adults. But I think the older one gets, the less influence the family has on one, traditionally. And also some families are extremely toxic. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, a very big etiological fact in addiction is early family trauma, and for most addicts, the reason they are the way they are is because they had very poor family dynamics, and very often that family dynamics remain that toxic. I think I heard Patrick Carnes once say, John Bradshaw say, that you should not live in a 200-mile radius from your family in the first 2 years of recovery.
Mm.
I think he said it sort of in jest, but I think there's some value in that.
Yeah.
So if a family is willing to come on board, great. And I think a treatment provider should really try that, just as part of the course. But if the family isn't willing to come on board, then I think the person in recovery also needs to be informed in a way that, listen, your family isn't really functioning as a protective factor or a support, but it's actually a risk factor, and it's actually a contributing factor towards your distress, and it might actually lead to relapse. And I think in cases like that, you should actually be warned against his family and treat going to his family in the same sense as going to a bar or a nightclub. I mean, how many people have I come across that have been clean for 6 months, 8 months, they go home for Christmas and they relapse?
Yeah.
It's not because there's alcohol involved, it's because the old dynamics come back. If you look at the dynamics that happen with people with family trauma, they regress back to sometimes even sort of infantile states because they are re-exposed to the trauma, and when they're in that state, then they're much more prone to relapse. So to reframe the statement, I would say that the lower left quadrant is absolutely essential, but it depends who you term your family. So I would rather say that the individual is in a position where he can create a family for himself, whether that is a sort of extended family of the fellowship or people mm-hmm. he met in a recovery or, you know, therapist sponsor, etc. I would say, yes, family is important, but not blood family. I certainly won't say is crucial for ongoing recovery.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So it's a broader notion. I mean, I'm hearing this from all of us. It's a broader notion of what constitutes family, kind of in the spirit of what Eddie said, families, friends, and fellows, that it's the relational domain, but it can't be defined by blood necessarily or geographics or whatever you want to say. Let me toss something out to you guys. We have a presenter coming next week here to the university who, in fact, it'll be available online if any of you are interested in it. He's going to be presenting on the interpersonal neurobiology of addiction. I don't know him, and I haven't been involved in getting him here. But he's going to be presenting here, and he'll be looking at how it is. I'm assuming he'll be looking at how it is that, you know, especially in the last 10 years of brain research and so on, that there's become more and more of an awareness that we don't operate as islands, that we really, to put it in that language, we really co-regulate each other. And I'm assuming that'll be the focus of his talking about addiction. I'll be going to the presentation. We co-regulate each other. And you've got people going to John's Wilderness Recovery or Guy's treatment setting or Eddie's treatment setting. We have people coming into recovery that are being exposed to pretty advanced technologies of practice and personal recovery. How essential is it, do you think, that families do get involved? Or what are the possible costs of families not getting more involved? So little Johnny or Susie goes away to Wilderness Recovery in Utah, comes home and is suddenly, you know, involved in eating right and exercising and practicing meditation with John's CDs playing and so on, and the family around him is kind of putting along with whatever they've typically done. And I've just wondered about this, just like an open conversation about it. Any thoughts about that in terms of looking at kind of continuing recovery, long-term recovery?
Well, if I can perhaps add something to that.
Please do.
you know, I think what's important in an integral perspective or any form of holistic lifestyle approach is to understand which practices, you know, on a scale of efficacy, which practices has the most efficacy relative to the specific disease. So, for instance, you know, one could easily say, yeah, you know, jogging and eating and this, everything is good. You know, it doesn't matter what disease you have. But for instance, if you have a broken leg, you know, no amount of interpersonal relationships is going to resolve that. You need a very medical approach.
Vice versa,
if it's schizophrenia or something, you know, you can, you know, drink vitamin, you know, take vitamins, but it's not going to resolve your underlying neurophysiology that needs to be addressed through medication or something. And I think with addiction, why a lot of the so-called holistic approaches don't necessarily work any better. I mean, there's no proof that if you add yoga or vitamins or anything like that to conventional addiction treatment, that it actually improves the treatment yet that I've encountered. So I think what's important is to understand the nature of the illness, and then see which, you know, like Wilbur says in his sort of spectrum of therapies, you know, all therapies are relevant to some extent, but depending on where the problem is, certain therapies are more relevant. So somebody with borderline personality disorder, structure building therapy like DBT is going to be more effective than transpersonal therapy or existential analysis or something.
Yes.
Where if it's a businessman that's 45 years old and he's struggling with life issues, then obviously DBT is not going to work that well. He needs existential analysis, etc. So I think in the context of what we're talking about, if one really starts looking at the etiology of addiction from a lower left quadrant and start understanding what pathology that as created in the individual, I think then one can start having a conversation on listening to what type of left, bottom left quadrant practices are going to be the most effective. And as far as I'm concerned, human beings only exist. There is no such thing as an individual human being. It's a construct that's got very positivist. It's based on a positivist foundation. I believe that human beings only exist in the construct of the, let's call it the Herber's eye, our relationship. I mean, there is nothing else that can be regarded as an individual that doesn't purely exist within relationship to others. Every single thing we think is due to others' influences. Every word we use is a social construct. Everything we are, but pretty much. So I would go, you know, more the extreme to the other side. And I think for addicts in particular, I think the biggest etiological factor, and I think there's certain research to back that up, is poor interpersonal relationships is one of the biggest etiological variables in the cause of addiction. Some guys like Philip Flores or Ulman and Paul or any of those guys would go as far as to say that that is the only real etiological factors. And even somebody like Alex.
Did you say poor interpersonal relationships?
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to make sure I got that right. I'm sorry I interrupted.
That's great.
No problem. Anytime. And somebody even like Bruce Alexander that works on a sort of new Marxist approach of the globalization of addiction. Ultimately, his theory boils down to that due to your lower right quadrant, it creates poor dynamics in groups of people, which leads to sort of lack of psychosocial integration. And what psychosocial integration ultimately is the capacity you have to relate to other people and yourself and the world. And if that is damaged, that leads to addiction. And there's tons of evidence that, you know, if you look at the American Indians or all these native tribes, as soon as their culture is destroyed, addiction runs rampant. But it's not the culture that's the etiological fact, is that it affects something inside of them. So my personal opinion would be is that looking, understanding addiction as more of a field rather than a single point, the place where addiction is the most powerfully present is in the lower left quadrant and in the lower in the upper left quadrant. And those two variables together are the person has learned how to relate to others is really gonna, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the primary factors. Therefore, I would say that treatment in that area needs to be one of the primary forms of treatment.
I
think that any treatment that doesn't have a very, very sophisticated lower left quadrant isn't going to be effective, because that's where the biggest problem lies. You know, treatment. Some treatment can have virtually no upper right quadrant, virtually no lower right quadrant, and still be effective. You know, and some treatment can have no upper left quadrant and just purely be communal, like for instance, religious treatment. You know, it's only lower left, and it seems to work for some people. So what I'm saying, to cut a long story short, is that the most essential component in any form of treatment, and where treatment needs to be the most focused, is the lower left. Everything, in a way, is at the service of the lower left. And if there isn't long-term treatment in the lower left, where people can relearn poor object relations and sort of change that narcissistic wounding, then really any form of treatment, as far as I'm concern, is going to be unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. So to get you back to your question, Bob, you know, I think all the holistic stuff is very useful and very necessary. But a lot of times those things are done in a way, they get given the same priority, nearly sort of the same methodological yes. or nearly the same epistemological priority as the bigger guns, like, for instance, social support. And I think that is a problem. You know, just drinking multivitamin clearly can't have the same curative effect as being in a supportive community. So I think it's important to have a sort of a scale of priority of what type of treatment is the most effective when it comes to addiction.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Hamlet, you said that this was really resonating for you. Do you want to comment on that? I'd invite you to. Question. Good question, Hamlet.
Yeah, I think that's. I think everything I said is in a way a preamble to that, because I think to answer that question adequately, one needs to understand the nature of the beast that you're trying to deal with. And I think once one has a sort of fairly working understanding of addiction from the lower left quadrant, then one can start speculating as to what therapeutic treatment will be effective. So I would say. You know, one of the reasons why I've always been a big supporter of the 12 steps, in fact, the main reason, I certainly won't say the only reason, because the 12 steps works also in a much more nuanced way and a much more subtle way than most people give it credit for. But the biggest reason why I will always be an adherent to the 12-step program is because of the accessible fellowship that it provides worldwide for free. And I would like to add the word for free, put emphasis on that, you know, because in the global, you know, a lot of people are trying to come with this model, and these things are all great, but it needs to be understood in the lower right-hand quadrant where most people can't afford neurotherapy or a dietitian or, you know, 4 yoga sessions a week or 4 Freudian psychoanalytic sessions a week. So to get back to your question, is that the first thing I would recommend to anybody is that he joins the 12-step fellowship, for the simple reason that it's accessible and it's free, and it gives you a network of like-minded people where you're basically your narcissistic wounding and your need for transference and this very powerful object hunger that addicts have, which they try and deny, can be slowly satisfied in a very infantile way. And I say infantile not as a negative thing in this case. And then my second choice would be, if somebody doesn't do a 12-step fellowship, I would say to him, listen here, okay, seeing you don't want to do the 12 steps, you need to come back to me and give me another option. That is necessarily not that powerful, because obviously there aren't very few, but you need to convince me that there's another social network out there that can give you something remotely as adequate as the 12-step environment does. And if the person can, then I'd say, well, fine, then you can use that one. But if somebody says to me, listen, he hasn't really got a support system, he's got a buddy here, and his mother, you know, cooks him tomato soup every weekend, and his girlfriend is very supportive. You know, she'll hide his crack if she sees him using. Then I'm going to say to him straight out, listen here, man, the chance of you getting better is like close to 0% because you're not going to get better on your own. So it leaves one in a difficult position because most people don't have well-established social support when they at the end, late stage of addiction, because they fucked it all up. So it's very difficult to just to establish this massive network of people. And I've never seen anybody, or I won't say never, I've very seldom have seen people cleaned up that don't have a very solid social support system. I've seen people clean up through religious networks or a Buddhist network, and sometimes even a therapeutic network. But then the ones that can clean up within a therapeutic milieu normally have very strong family support. To give you the short answer, I would say something like the 12 steps, or if he's part of a very well-established fellowship of some other nature, I would recommend that. And then the probably the least effective is some form of therapeutic social support system, like a lot of groups, maybe more interaction with these therapists and stuff like that. But that will probably be the least effective.
Yeah. I really like what you're saying, Guy. I'm going to have to excuse myself in just a minute, gentlemen. You're welcome to continue. I've got to leave right now for a meeting. I'd like to think of this as being our first kind of pass through the lower left-hand quadrant, and it invites a lot more questions and analysis. I love the breadth and the depth that you bring, Guy. I really have a lot of respect for what you've said. I wish we had another hour right now, because I'd love to continue the conversation. You guys are welcome to continue. I will excuse myself, and then we'll be meeting again on Thursday. Hamlet, I should say, Guy will be leading on Thursday. I'll be actually presenting at this panel on Thursday. So I'll plan to see you all next Tuesday, okay?
Guy, I'll see you on Thursday.
Okay, thanks a million. Thank you, Guy. Thanks, Hamlet.
Okay.
Bye-bye for now.